You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in London, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have allowed me to make these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Steiner's second medical course, volume 313 in the collected works, entitled Illness and Therapy, Spiritual Scientific Aspects of Healing, translated by Matthew Barton. This is lecture one given in Dornach on the 11th of April, 1921. I hope that this supplementary course will really augment and enlarge on last year's course, and by the end will crystallize into a number of therapeutic perspectives. My efforts in this course will focus on examining things that formed the subject of our previous observations, human illness and the search for cures, but now from a different angle. However, since we will be looking at things from a different point of view, we will not only discover different aspects, but also broaden the scope of our previous studies. In particular, on this occasion, I would like to show what happens in the human organization you are all familiar with as anthroposophists, in terms of physical body, etheric body, and so forth, when we fall ill and when we recover. Last time, I mostly confined myself to presenting the way our inner nature manifests outwardly. This time, in contrast, I will try to show how the diverse levels of the human being are affected by substances external to us, what the real nature of these substances is, which can then be used as medicines, and what can act as a medicine by affecting the human organism in other than merely material ways. Here, however, I will first need to offer a proviso by way of introduction. On the last occasion, when we discussed the same themes, we also spoke in many respects of substances and physical remedies. Now, though, as we come to consider the higher constituting levels of human nature, the supersensible human bodies, we will need to speak about substances in a different way. While we refer to them in what I would call an abbreviated way, we will nevertheless have to remember a fact and principle throughout, that we cannot assume the nature of substance to be as the scientific community commonly regards it today, if we really wish to understand our relationship to our environment and what characterizes us in a state of health and sickness. Rather than substances per se, we must start from processes, developmental processes rather than finished products. And whenever we speak of substance, we must really visualize how the external sensory appearance that a substance presents to us is in fact nothing other than a process that has come to rest. If we have silica before us, for instance, siliceous earth, we initially regard it as a substance. But we overlook the key thing if in doing so we picture it as a particular entity with defined boundaries. We only pinpoint the essential thing about it if we consider what is present as a single, very extensive process throughout the whole universe. This process can, as it were, crystallize and come to rest, can culminate in a kind of equilibrium, and on coming to rest, manifest as silica. It is vital to consider the mutual effect between processes within us and those which unfold outside in the universe, with which we stand in continual reciprocity, both in sickness and health. To establish the basis for embarking on our actual studies tomorrow, I wish to present today something that can really lead us to ideas about this reciprocal effect. Here, we have to try to understand the nature of the human being in terms of anthroposophic, spiritual science. I will first express myself somewhat schematically, focusing on what I have often presented as the threefold human being, but now in really concentrated, localized form in us. We know that the neurosensory system is largely concentrated in the head, although what is concentrated in the head is actually also spread out everywhere in us, is present everywhere in us. That in the head we are mostly, as it were, a being of nerves and senses. But on the other hand, that we are also all head, though less so in the other two realms than in the head. Thus we can picture what we call our neurosensory system as being localized in the head. But to make good use, for our present purposes, of the way we understand this human organization, we should really see the rhythmic system, comprising everything relating to respiration and circulation, as being, in turn, divided into two parts, one part tending more toward the respiratory system and the other more toward the circulatory system. And then, integrated into this circulatory system, is everything that embodies the connection between our limb system and metabolic system. If we study the human head, we are also, in a sense, studying the part of the human organism that is mostly our neurosensory aspect. The organization of the human head is very different from that of the other two systems, also in relation to the form of the higher aspects of human nature. If we consider the human head from an anthroposophic perspective, it is a kind of replica, or one might even say a deposit, of the capital I, the astral body, and the etheric body. And then let us see how the physical body relates to the head. This physical body is, in fact, one can say, present in the head in a different way from the physical that is a replica or imprint of the I, the astral body, and the etheric body. Here I would like to accentuate the higher nature of these things by drawing attention to the fact that the human head, in its first foundations in the human embryo, is not configured solely by the forces of the parental organism, but that cosmic forces are at work in it, that cosmic forces simply work into the human being. A great deal of the parental organism is at work in what we call the etheric forces. Yet even there, in the etheric, cosmic forces are at work from the pre-birth realm. Or we could say that soul spiritual life prior to conception. And even in the astral and the I, there is an after effect of what lived in the world of spirit before conception. It continues to work by exerting a formative effect on the human head. The I creates its imprint in the human head. The astral body creates its physical imprint. The etheric body likewise creates its physical imprint. Only the physical body, which is of course first acquired only here on the physical earth, is what we can call a prime mover, not an imprint or replica, but something of primary effect. If I draw this schematically, and there's a picture, I can say that the human head is formed as an imprint of the I, capital. Within, this organizes itself in a certain way, and we will come back to this organization repeatedly. It initially does so chiefly by inwardly differentiating the head's temperature. In addition, the astral body differentiates itself inside here and is primarily encompassed as organizing force in the gaseous, air-related processes that permeate the head. Again, see figure 1. Then the etheric body imprints itself. And then what is physical body for the head is a physical process. A really physical process. Figure 1 shaded portion. I will indicate this by schematic representation, in the drawing of the part of the head that is the bony occiput, with eye level about here. But again, the physical forces concentrated here extend over the whole head. Here, in this physical part of the human head, we have a real primary physical process. This is not the manifestation of something else, but accomplishes its own process. Yet in the physical head process, nevertheless, we have a duality, an interplay of two processes. What happens here is an interplay of two processes that we can only understand if, in our spiritual research, we relate them to certain other processes occurring outside in the universe. If you take a look at the primary geological process expressed in schist formation, in fact, in everything that leads from siliceous earth to schist or shale formation, then you will find in the forces at work in this process of schist formation originating in silica the polar opposite process to that which unfolds, on the one hand, in the physical formation of the head. Here you find an important connection between us and our surroundings. Within the human head, a process is at work that unfolds in our external surroundings in mineralization. Today, in geology, people have almost, though not quite, come to realize that everything connected with the process of schist formation, of mineralization involving silica, is related to what one might call devegetabilization. Devegetabilization. We should regard schist formation as a mineralized plant realm. In trying to understand this devegetabilization, which is the same as the Earth's schist-forming processes, we grasp the same process that unfolds in a different way here in the human head, in its polar opposite form. There is, however, an interplay here with another process. And this other process that plays in here has again to be sought in the external world. We have to look for it in limestone formations. Once again, geology, as external science, is now close to accepting the truth that limestone formations are based on a geological process which we could call a de-animalization process, one which is the reversal of what gives rise to the animal. And once again, it is the polar opposite process that is at work here. So, if we ascribe to silica and to calcium processes that have come to rest in substance, a part in the formation of the physical human head, we have to realize that something plays into this physical head formation that has a very important role in the whole of surrounding nature. At the same time, by way of preparation, we can orient ourselves by seeing silica, on the one hand, and I am speaking of silica as a process that has come to rest, in its key relationship with what happens in the human head. And by seeing limestone formation, on the other hand, or the calcium process that has come to rest, as connected with all that is embodied in the opposite pole and works in polar reciprocity with the other force in the physical human head. These processes, which today we can still find everywhere around us, are connected in the human head with others that we do not find on the earth, and that are present only as imprint, insofar as the head is an impression of etheric body, astral body, and I. In relation to these higher members of the human being, we have processes that have come to rest, but are not directly earthly processes. The only true earthly process is what I have spoken of here in regard to the physical head per se. The other processes are not true earth processes, although, as we will see, they are connected to earth processes. To gain an overview, I will now pass straight on to the second realm of the human organism, which we locate in very general terms as the chest. This is the part of the human organism that chiefly encompasses the rhythmic system. Let us immediately divide this schematically, firstly into all that comprises the breathing rhythm, and secondly into all that comprises the circulatory rhythm. If we wish to consider as a whole this second part of the human being, we must say the following. All that I have here called the organization of the breathing rhythm in the broadest sense, see figure 2, is initially an imprint of the I and astral body. See also plate 1. Just as the head is an imprint of the I, astral body, and etheric body, so this breathing rhythm is an impression of the I and astral body. While both physical body and etheric body work together in what takes primary effect here, see shaded part of drawing. The physical body alone has a primary effect in the human head, where the etheric body is also an imprint. In the breathing rhythm system, however, a primary interaction of physical and etheric body is at work, while I and astral body only imprint themselves upon it. This is also largely the case in the circulatory rhythm organization, but in a weaker form, as the whole metabolic organism intrudes into the circulatory system. But here, there is already a beginning of what then holds good for the metabolic and limb system. We then have a state of affairs in which the limbs, with all that works into them as metabolism, with the exception of circulation as such, thus of the movement present there, are fundamentally an imprint of the I and an interplay of physical body, etheric body, and astral body. See figure 3. Thus we can say that in considering the human chest system, the imprint organization present there is really only what relates to I and astral body, while active within it is a primary organization that is not merely physical now, but shows the physical to be informed and structured by the etheric. This is more strongly so in the breathing system, while in the circulatory rhythm we have something else working in from the metabolic system. See also plate 1. You can see this at work in various types of interplay in the different parts of the human being. In these different physical realms, which we call the head system, chest system, and limb system, we find different modes of interaction between the levels or bodies, which in spiritual science we call the physical body, etheric body, astral body, and I. The human head, as process, is really largely physical body, while all that is not physical body works as an imprint of the I, astral body, and etheric body. Our middle system is largely an interplay of physical body and etheric body, and what is not either physical or etheric body there is an imprint of the I and astral body. The metabolic and limb system is really entirely an interplay of physical body, etheric body, and astral body, and an imprint of the I. But, as I have said, works also into the other systems in interaction with them. Now we must firstly consider how the middle system is informed by the process we illustrated in relation to the physical head organization, as participation of the silica process that has come to rest. Here we find the remarkable fact that in the middle system, the process of silica formation has a stronger, more widespread effect. In the head, its action is finer, subtler. Here in the middle system, it works in a stronger, more widespread, and in a sense more differentiated way. and it works most strongly of all in the metabolic and limb system. So if we now consider the process we have seen as being related to silica, we find that it works most strongly where it is required to aid the eye. We will see the reciprocal effect with other processes too. In regard to the action of the autonomous eye that has only its imprint in our physical metabolic system. This silica-engendering process works most strongly where it is required to aid the eye, in the action of this eye upon the metabolic and limb system. Thus this process, which can be characterized in terms of silica, works somewhat more weakly, where it only needs to aid the astral body, and most weakly of all, where it need only help the etheric body, that is, in the head. One might put this the other way round, too. In relation to the process, we must regard as coming to rest in silica. We find that its action is most material in the head organization, while it works there most weakly in relation to its dynamic impetus or force. But where it works most weakly as force, it takes strongest effect in approaching a static state within substance. Thus, if we see silica as the substance present there, we must say that its effect is strongest in the head. If, in contrast, we see it as the outward sign of a process, we have to say that its weakest influence is in the head. Where the strongest material effect exists, the weakest dynamic influence occurs. In our middle system, material and dynamic effect are roughly in equilibrium. And in relation to the metabolic and limb system, the dynamic effect largely has the upper hand. Here we have the weakest material effect and the strongest dynamic influence. And thus the process which gives rise to silica really permeates the whole human being with an organizing effect. Having asked about the nature of the reciprocal relationship between the physical head organization and our external surroundings, we can then go on to inquire into the nature of the reciprocal interplay between our middle system, insofar as it is organized as breathing rhythm, and the world around us. If we wish to study and understand the human head, we have to look at the two processes in earth formation whereby limestone and silica, or, if you like, silicic acid, arise. We will be looking at this in closer detail. The aspect of us that is less external, less peripheral, and lies more internally, the rhythmic organization of the breathing system, is, as we saw, a primary interplay of physical and etheric into which the eye and astral are woven as impressions. Nowhere in our external surroundings, initially, do we find anything that directly embodies this as a natural process, or at least this is not usually so. If we wish to find a process characteristic of what occurs there through this unique interplay of eye, astral body, which are more or less free through their imprinting action, and what acts in a primary way there as an interaction of physical and etheric, this whole interplay can only be properly sought in the external world if we ourselves first engender it. When we burn plant substances and thereby obtain plant ash, the fire and ash forming process, the process reflected and embodied in such burning and engendering of ash, and in the coming to rest of the ash, we will speak in a moment of different kinds of ash, is related to the breathing process in a way similar to that in which the silica process is related to the process occurring physically in the head. And if we wish to render the correlation to this ash-forming process effective in the rhythmic breathing process, we naturally cannot introduce it into the breath. We can never do this in the human organism, but must instead introduce it into what is, as it were, its other pole. If I draw this, see plate 1, right. Then we have here the rhythmic breathing process and rhythmic circulation process. In the rhythmic breathing process, plant ashes characterize the active processes. But we have to activate this plant ash processes on a roundabout route via the metabolism at the other pole in the rhythmic circulatory organism. See figure 4. We have to incorporate these plant ashes, in other words, their dynamic forces, into the circulatory rhythm so that they can then call forth their polar counter image in the rhythmic breathing process. These relationships reveal themselves to direct perception as being of eminent importance for understanding the human organism. Just as we saw that what is present in the silica-forming process is closely connected with the whole human being, by applying this now to the plant ash-forming process, we gain a picture of this middle system in us, which in turn is, in a sense, dual in nature, having both a breathing and a circulatory rhythm. We gain an idea of this if we say that in the upper rhythm, that of breathing, the structure of the organs concerned is largely determined by a process that is polar opposite to the one revealed when we burn plant material and thereby obtain ash. In the rhythmic breathing process, there is, one can say, a continual battle going on against the forming of plant ash, but a battle that does not occur without penetration of the organism by the opposite of this process, in a way that really challenges it. As human beings, we live upon an earth in which there are these silica and calcareous processes. If these processes were to fill us, we would not be human beings. We are human beings by virtue of bearing within us processes that are polar opposite to these. In other words, we can counter the silica formation process and bear its opposite pole within us, and likewise counter the calcium forming process by bearing its opposite pole within us. We bear these poles within us by virtue of our head formation, which works through the whole human being in different degrees, as I described. Through our breathing rhythm, we combat the plant ash-forming process. We carry within us the opposite of this plant ash-forming process. When we consider these things, it will scarcely be surprising that, to put it somewhat crassly, each impetus invokes a counter-impetus. It is quite clear, therefore, that if I intensify the silica-forming process in the organism, the counter-effect will be modified accordingly. And it is equally clear that if I introduce the product of the combustion process into the organism, a corresponding counter-effect will be created. This leads to the big question as to how we can gain control over this action and counteraction. In abstract terms, this is something I always express by saying that we first have to recognize what processes are actually at work in the human organism, extending as far as the eye, capital, and what processes are at work outside us, outside the human organism. These processes are differentiated inside and outside us. But inside and outside, they are polar opposite to each other. The moment something, which by its intrinsic nature should lie outside of my skin, is inside my skin, or the moment something works from outside inward, even if this is just a slight pressure on the body, that by rights should not do so. This elicits an inner counteraction. And at that moment it is my task to create an inner counteraction of this kind to whatever has entered from without. If, for instance, I find that instead of the normal silica-countering process, this process has become excessive or too intense, I need to regulate it from without by administering the relevant substance and invoking the counter-response, which then arises by itself. These things gradually lead us to insight into the reciprocal relationship between us and our natural surroundings. If you can really grasp how the dynamic involved in the silica-forming process reciprocates and responds to the eye when the latter seeks to act through the limbs and metabolism, and if, moreover, you know that the material effect in the silica-forming process works most strongly in the head, at the same time seeing that its dynamic action is only needed to a lesser degree to aid the eye in the human head, then you will be able to gain insight into how this eye works in different degrees within us. If we now consider the relationship of the human eye to the metabolic and limb system, we find there really the source of human egotism. This system of human egotism also, of course, includes the sexual system, and the eye acts to penetrate the human entity with egotism, precisely also on the roundabout route through the sexual system. If you grasp this, you will say that there is a certain opposition between the way in which the eye uses silica in order to act upon us from the limb system and the way in which this same eye works from the human head through silica, where in a sense it acts without egotism. If we study this through spiritual science, we see a differentiating effect here. If I depict this remarkable effect schematically, I must say that what the eye does in us when acting through silica from the limb system, figure 5 in red, now is a real organizing element, is fundamentally a cohesive effect on us, as it were binding all fluids present in us into an undifferentiated unity and giving rise to an undifferentiated unified whole. See plate, also plate 1. Everything that, while involving the same process, forms silica in the least intensive way in terms of dynamic force, acts in the opposite way. See figure 5, yellow. Exerting a differentiating and radiating action. From below upward, the human being is encompassed, unified and rendered undifferentiated through silica, while from above downward, he is differentiated into separate aspects. This means, however, that the action of forces organically present in the head is differentiated for the different organs. These forces are in a sense stimulated by the silica process, intrinsic to the head, to work as they should, to distribute themselves appropriately to heart, liver, and so forth. Here we meet a process which in working from below upward merges and jumbles everything up in us, and when it works from above downward, structurally separates everything, as it were ruling the organism and organizing each separate organ appropriately. If we then perceive what occurs in us through this jumbling up on the one hand and on the other this driving apart into diverse organs, that is, a differentiating mode of organization in contrast to a synthesizing one, and see how this can be irregular in each individual, then we gradually learn to treat a patient with this in mind when a disorder arises. We will see this in more detail in the lectures that follow. but in examinations of this kind we must really be extremely careful. For what does an external scientific approach actually discover in examining the human organism? Scientists state, for example, that there is silica in the human organism, fluorine, magnesium, and calcium. External scientific analysis shows that we have silica in our hair, blood, and urine. Now, let us first take these two. Silica is present in our hair and urine. An external approach considers that there is nothing else to be said, except that we find silica in human hair and then again silica in human urine. But the fact that some substance or other is present somewhere is not the important thing. The silica in our hair is there as a source of activity. We do not have hair for no reason. But from our hair, forces pass in turn to the organism. And in fact, the very finest, subtlest forces pass from our hair back into the organism. We have silica in our urine as something that is otherwise superfluous. What is not used is excreted there. In fact, silica in urine is a matter of indifference. It is not active there, but is just in the process of being expelled as something that should not be active, of which there is too much. The urine contains silica that should not be in the organism, and which therefore has not the slightest significance for it. It is the same when we examine any distinct substance, let us say magnesium. If there were no magnesium in our teeth, they would not be teeth at all. In the magnesium process live forces that are most closely involved in building up the teeth. You heard this in Professor Romer's talk. But according to materialistic science, magnesium is also in milk. Yet there it has no significance. By its very nature, milk is strong enough to expel the magnesium it contains. Magnesium, as such, has no intrinsic place in milk. We can analyze it, of course, but in fact the milk-producing process can arise through the fact that it can expel magnesium forces. We only learn something about this remarkable contrast between the processes of dental development and milk production by knowing that magnesium belongs intrinsically and dynamically to the dental development process. In the milk-producing process, on the other hand, it is surplus to requirements and is expelled. Things are similar with fluorine, for example, which plays a key part in dental enamel and which is essential to our understanding of the process of dental evolution. It is also present in the urine, but there as excretion process and without significance to this. The fluorine present in the urine is, in fact, what the organism is powerful enough to excrete because it cannot use it. A merely physical analysis of whether a particular substance is present somewhere really doesn't tell us anything of importance. We always need to know whether something is playing an active part at the right place or whether it is just present because it has been expelled or excreted. That is the decisive thing. The key thing is that we acquire such concepts so as to understand health and sickness in the human being and other organic entities. Yet, speaking in a more accessible way, always requires us to dispense with these aids, because in our age people in general have not been educated to grasp subtler concepts. It becomes necessary to speak more abstractly and therefore less comprehensibly. We frequently become incomprehensible when combating materialism. But if we descend, we might still descend into quite different regions as well, into the characteristic nature of realms which scientists really ought to know, whose facts are available to them and can be studied and analyzed. Then precisely through spiritual science we can demonstrate that the idea of particular substances which chemical and physical analysis locates in particular places in fact leads to nothing but error. This was by way of introduction. We will speak further of these things tomorrow. The end of Lecture 1.